Hey, welcome to Coffee with Creamer. This is Lucius. It's kind of been a while since the last podcast, but I'm excited to have a very special friend of mine on the podcast today. His name is Isaac Van Doren. He's a longtime friend of mine, and as he's just about finished with his first semester of college, after absolutely ditching me this semester, we're going to get into how his life has changed from going to college from high school, and his ideas on philosophy and simulation theory, as well as what makes a human a human. It's an interesting podcast, and it's going to cover a lot of difficult topics, but Isaac kind of gives it that cheery charm to all of it. It's going to keep it fun for you. Enjoy.
We're on air. Welcome to Coffee with Creamer. My name is
That is my job. You shut up.
All right, I promise once we're talking, I'm not going to be an idiot.
Yeah, sure. No, I don't think you can turn that off.
Being an idiot?
Yeah.
You're going to put all of this in the podcast.
Absolutely. No, yeah. This is not coming out. I'm a drummer. Hello. Welcome to Coffee with Creamer. Today, I'm joined with Isaac Van Doren. He is a longtime friend of mine.
Isaac Van Doren?
Look at Isaac Van Doren. Look, he's such a cool guy. Yeah. It's going to be a great podcast. I'm going to start out with a fairly obligatory question. How do you like your coffee, Isaac?
Black all the way. I don't really drink coffee that much, but when I do, I definitely go black. I think, honestly, a lot of that is an ego thing that I like saying to myself that I don't need cream and sugar, you know, that I'm, like, somehow more sophisticated because I can enjoy coffee just by itself, you know, like, yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. Like, no one that I have interviewed has said that they like creamer. Like,
really?
All, like, Riley, McFarland, and you, they all like it black.
Huh. What? How do you like your coffee?
I like mine with a little bit of creamer. Either, like, if it depends. So, like, I'll have a dessert coffee sometimes at, like, a nice place. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I will just use, like, cream. So, not, like, creamer, like, no sugar or anything, just, like, cream or half and half. But if I'm doing it to, like, wake up or, like, just have a cup of coffee, then I'll usually use creamer. And that's usually whatever's available. I don't really care. Like, I don't have a specific type of creamer that I like. But
well, and that's, like, sometimes even some – there's, like, at Starbucks or something, there's some drinks that sound really good. But then I see on the menu it's, like, 450 calories.
Yeah. You
know? And it's like, whoa.
And that doesn't really worry me too much. Like, I don't really care about calorie count too whole lot. Maybe that's just because, like, it doesn't matter to me because I have a high enough metabolism at this point.
Well, I mean, if we're being honest, it doesn't really matter for me either, but I don't drink soda because of, you know, just unnecessary sugar, so then I don't want to drink a pumpkin spice latte. It's, like, the same as drinking two cans or something like that.
So. Yeah. Yeah, I get you. I don't know. Oh, that's a good question. If you were to drink coffee, why would you drink coffee?
Well, occasionally I drink it for taste, and occasionally I drink it for energy. So I think it'd be a combination of both. This year I've been trying to avoid caffeine, which I've been pretty successful with, just because I don't want to start, especially this is my first semester of college, and I don't want to be relying on caffeine to get me out of bed in the morning. Because, you know, even just sometimes senior year, it'd be so hard to go to class. And so I started getting in the habit of having some more coffee, or sometimes I drink like a kickstart in the morning, which people would judge me for, you know. But I don't want to have to rely on that. But if I did, it'd probably be for energy, but then at the same time, a little bit of enjoyment, because I do like things in the same vein as coffee, like tea or LaCroix,
which are
not sweet, but have kind of like a, not a bitter flavor, but it's not like a, it's like a,
right, it's not more a of an sweet or a flavorful flavor. Yeah. It's just like a bland kind of.
Well, no, don't say bland.
Yeah, no, I guess bland is the wrong word.
It's
not extravagant,
kind of, maybe.
Okay, yeah. I can see sharper.
Just less comfortable, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay, so there's your icebreaker for the day. So is there anything that you would like to say to the people listening to the podcast before we get really started? Anything you want people to know about you or anything like
that? Well, I'm a freshman at Lipscomb University in Nashville, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
I am a computer science major, and I play drums, and I love music, and I love Jesus.
There you go.
And I'm an extrovert computer science major, which I'm proud of.
Do you think that an extrovert computer science major, do you think that's a majority of the computer science majors?
Not at all. No, it's
not at all? Even at Lipscomb, where you're going to?
Certainly not. I think about two-thirds of the majors are probably introverts,
mm-hmm.
but that's a big change. In the past, it used to be a lot higher.
Yeah. Do you think that's like self-proclaimed introverts, or do you think that's like Isaac-proclaimed introverts?
I mean, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert is really self-proclaimed,
because
it's hard. You can study some. I mean, you could study someone and see their patterns and try to determine, but really it matters what they tell you of where their energy comes from or what they would want to do in different situations. So, I mean, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't need to be super accurate, but I think most people are honest. They're not trying to pretend to be extroverts or anything like that.
Yeah, I get you. Okay, so you've been attending college for almost a semester. How has that changed the way that you shape your life, or the way that you schedule everything, or your routine? How has that changed the way that you just go about a general day?
Yeah, it's a lot. I'm way more productive than I've ever been in my life,
mm-hmm.
and way more efficient, just because I have so much more to do, especially with a computer science major and music minor. I've procrastinated a lot less out of necessity, for really just because I still want to hang out with friends, you know, and I still want to just relax sometimes. But if I want to do that, I have to be really on top of getting my stuff done, and I can't just blow it off because then it's going to come back to bite me. So that's been the biggest change. Is just being really intentional about getting stuff done, you know. But then I think a really big thing I've learned in that is to take time to be inefficient, because sometimes I'll have a small gap in the day where I could try to squeeze something in, but if I do, I'm not really going to make that much headway. So in the grand scheme of things, it's better to just enjoy spending time with whoever I'm with or goof off or something like that, and then work on it later. And that helps my days not seem too long or monotonous or like I'm just trying to get through the day or something, but that it, you know, so that I can enjoy the time I'm in. So
yeah. So do you think that has like do you think that's made your enjoyment of like life in general more?
Yeah. Well,
or that would you like valuing the minutes that you have?
Yeah, I think that I've gotten into a better mindset to help me enjoy the rest of my life more in general, because, you know, realistically, there's never going to be a point in my life where I'm just going to have bountiful free time and feel like, and you don't enjoy life in the time you have free. You enjoy life doing life,
mm-hmm.
and learning how to enjoy life, whatever you're doing, I think is really important, you know, and just learning to enjoy learning in school and the assignments you have to do. I mean, maybe it's a pain, but you're probably learning something and finding how to appreciate that. It's been really good, and I think I'll take that into whatever I do in the future.
Mm-hmm. So, like, you're going into a computer science major, but you're going to Lipscomb. So what specifically about Lipscomb interests you or pulled you into Lipscomb as opposed to some other university that maybe has a more developed computer science program or something? Was that like geographical location, like being in Nashville, or was that more the diversity of academics in the university?
Yeah, so for me coming to Lipscomb, well, I wanted to go to a private school and a Christian school, private Christian school, and one that had a good computer science department. And already there are very few of those, because most Christian schools are not usually very good in technology. So that's what I was looking for, and Lipscomb meets those requirements. The computer science department is ABET accredited. But then really the thing that kind of tipped it over was the fact that it was in Nashville and has a commercial music department.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of some of the other places I was looking at are out in the middle of a cornfield or just far away from home,
yeah.
Which can't really compete with Nashville. And then having a commercial music department just is that's rare in itself, because there aren't very many places you can go to school and be involved with playing drum set at. You know, you can do mm-hmm. classical percussion, but that's nothing like drum set. So, yeah, that was those all those combined made me want to go there. And, you know, it's I could have gone to a better school academically probably,
mm-hmm.
but especially with computer science, I'll be fine getting a job, whatever. Like the department has 100% job placement rate.
Oh yeah, that's really good.
And that's like standard.
Yeah,
which is insane. But computer science is just in such demand that it doesn't matter.
So tell me more about like what an average day at Lipscomb is like, and how maybe Lipscomb specifically affects that day. So like a day that you could have at Lipscomb, but that you couldn't have, let's say, at Mizzou.
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, it really depends from person to person, and a lot mm-hmm. of it is the way you choose to take advantage of your surroundings. But some of the, I guess just some of the biggest differences between like Mizzou are the size, and that's really one of the biggest differences is that like my biggest class this semester started out with 34 people and then a bunch of drops, and now it's like 24 or something. But whereas, you know, Mizzou, you're going to have like 400, 500, 600 people in a lecture hall. So that means that you can have more personal relationships with professors,
mm-hmm.
which that's been really awesome. And getting to have conversations and then they knowing you. And then about it being a Christian school, there are lots of people who go there who aren't Christian, and a lot of people who go there just because their parents sent them there because they didn't want them to believe something different.
Yeah.
You know? But there are a good amount of people who are Christian there, so then it's just easier to have conversations about your faith, theology, or stuff like that than it would be at a public college. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, because it's small, you lose out on – there are some things that they just don't have because there aren't enough students or enough funding total. But
oh, yeah.
I definitely like it.
Do you think that you – or do you feel like you're missing out on maybe some things that you would have in a larger university due to the small size or the things that are provided to you? Or is that something that you feel like you're missing out on? Or do you feel like that's just like...
Really, no. Like, research, maybe. But mm-hmm. That's not something I'd want to do in my undergrad anyway. And there, I could maybe do some research at Vanderbilt or graduate school or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then even it's really the opposite. But I think there are a lot of things that I would be missing out at a bigger school because... For example, my involvement with the music department, because it is as small as it is, there aren't a lot of drummers. So then I get way more chances to play than I would if it was a bigger school, just because there just aren't other people, as many other people I'm competing with.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there are other ways I'm missing out, but I don't know what they are.
Yeah, gotcha.
Very thankful that I can go to the kind of school that I am going to.
Yeah. So... You have a girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
Ashley. How does having a girlfriend that is here and not in Nashville, how does that affect your scheduling and the way that you approach developing relationships and friendships at college?
Yeah, that's a good question. What's up, Ashley? I know you're listening. Yeah, it's a lot. And that goes into a lot about saying that I've been a lot more efficient and a lot more on top of my schedule. And that's because... You know, I want to talk to her, and mm-hmm. I can't just kind of, if I just sit around, then I have to let something go. I have to study less or not as much as I would like, mm-hmm. or not talk to her or not hang out with friends at school. So I have to be really on top of everything to get that in. But then it's been a lot about balance between our relationship long distance and then the people that I'm at school with, because one thing we talked about a lot before going into long distance is that we didn't want it to stop us from getting connected where we were each going to school, because that's going to end badly. And already we've both seen examples of people who are doing relationships either long distance or at school very poorly and then not getting connected the way they should. So we both try not to be too clingy, you know? And I think we actually do a pretty good job of that. There are times when she's doing something and I wish that she could talk, but that's selfish of me if I just wish that she wasn't hanging out with friends and doing something fun so she could talk to me. That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
So just learning to find balance and still making friends there, but still keeping up talking consistently and keeping up the relationship is that's been the biggest thing. And, you know, it's not easy, but I've grown a ton learning how to balance that and stay committed in that way.
Yeah. How has the major, computer science, that you're in affected the friendships that you have and the way that you interact with the college in a way that you think that maybe a different major wouldn't affect?
Yeah, well, I love my computer science friends. Mm-hmm. We can nerd out about computer science. And, you know, coming in, I wasn't thinking that I was going to want to hang out with people in the computer science major very much, because I thought they were all going to be weird and nerds. But then, you know, I'm weird and I'm a nerd and I love computer science and we love talking and hanging out, and they're not weird. And so we spend a lot of time just talking about different computer science concepts, you know, and it's really a good time. And I think computer science as a major is kind of, it's a really fun one, because business majors, like the way the business world is structured, if you walk into like a business professor's office, it's clean, it's organized, there are the awards and accolades they have, and you don't touch, you know, those things are shiny, like you don't go in there touching someone's trophies. But if you walk into a computer science professor's office, it's messy, there are, you know, papers on a chair, move them off, then there's a shelf, multiple shelves and a bookshelf just full of all the doodads and puzzles they have to play with, you know, and then you pick them up and mess with them. And that kind of culture within computer science, I really have fallen in love with. Just like a curiosity, exploring new puzzles and problems and trying to figure them out. And that's, you know, it goes from small things just for fun into like the big core aspects of what the field is about.
Gotcha. So you also have a music minor that you're doing right now. Is it just music? So what's the specific name of that?
Technically, it's a commercial music minor.
Commercial music minor.
With like, you can go different ways with it, but I'll be going a production emphasis.
Okay. So do those two programs mesh at all?
No.
do you feel like you're crossing, or that you're like standing in the middle of like two groups of friends and there's no melding? Is that something that you see some sort of conflict in?
Well, so interesting about the music department, pretty much all of the music majors almost only hang out with other music majors just because they spend so much time doing that. And that's not really true for other departments. But I don't, because I'm just a minor and I'm not opposed to that. I wouldn't want to have all my friends be only in one department. And as far as, you know, yeah, I actually have a friend who's also a computer science major and music minor, so we kind of share that. But I don't really have my music friends don't necessarily overlap a lot with my computer science ones. And you know, a lot of people ask me how I want to integrate computer science and music together, and they seem very perplexed by that when I first tell them what I'm majoring in. But really, I don't have plans to integrate it as far as like, you know, I could do an application of computer science, like say working for a company that's developing a music production software or something, but I don't plan on doing that.
Yeah.
It's more that being a music minor is the best way to be involved with the music department and play in ensembles and, you know, improve my craft as a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to, you know, play gigs on the weekends or something like that, but really just always be involved with music in some capacity. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really trying to make money with the music minor, and I already have made a little bit of money with it, and hopefully I'll make more, but that's, I'm not trying to support myself off of that.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard a lot of things about how music just kind of improves humans,
yes,
as a general thing. Do you think that that's maybe part of the reason that you're trying to continue your music? Or,
well, the reason I continue my music is just because I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I just love music and it's so fun. But I am very happy that it's something that I've decided to put time into. And, you know, because I see how good it has been for me trying to get good at music, because mm-hmm. it takes so much discipline if you want to really get good at music, for practicing. And then even performing music itself is so high stakes, and you have to be so meticulous with the way you play. And it really develops a lot of skills that I think are very applicable in other domains. Like, I've gained far more discipline from music than from really anything else, like, you know, school or anything like that. And I can apply that to any other area in my life.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to kind of take this in a completely different route.
All right.
So I wrote this question, I think, 2 days ago, and it's already out of date. I'm just going to read what I wrote, and then we'll see where we go.
Okay.
It said, you use a Pixel XL,
and
you talk about how you were thinking of switching to the iPhone XS Max constantly. What influenced that decision, and why do you want to switch to the XS Max specifically, and has computer science major affected this switch?
Oh my. Oh, this is juicy. So I am now the proud owner of iPhone XS Max. And, you know, I've been an Android guy for a long time, and I think I still am at the heart. I've just sold out, and I've distanced myself from my fellow Android brethren in that way. I guess the biggest reasons are for iMessage and AirDrop and FaceTime and like Apple group chats and stuff like mm-hmm. that, because the messaging is just so much better. And now Android's coming out with RCS.
Yep.
So soon maybe that difference will be null, but for just that's one of the biggest reasons. And then even just, it sounds petty, but I think the impression of having someone type in their phone number into your phone and seeing that it's an iPhone and that it's blue bubbles gives a good impression to people. But if we're being real, it's thanks to Ashley. So she gets credit for me switching to an iPhone. I think it'll be good for our relationship. She'd probably break up with me if I didn't. But yeah, and as far as computer science, that has absolutely nothing to do with it. And I mm-hmm. think it's also, you know, computer science really doesn't have that much always to do with specific things like what kind of phone you use or something
that.
And computer science majors aren't necessarily really techie or know that much about, like, you know, specific, like the new stuff coming down the pipeline from Google.
Yeah, consumer
like
electronics. They're not as big into like consumer electronics, well, like
not,
phones.
Not even
stuff.
That. It's just more that computer science is about a way of thinking and mm-hmm. problem solving that then gets applied to every aspect of computing. So like your phone, obviously, but it's so much bigger than that
mm-hmm.
that you don't need to be super proficient in IT and like know how modems and
yeah.
routers work and all that kind of stuff to be a computer science major. And it's just so much more about thinking. Like the famous computer scientist Edsger Dijkstra, he has a famous quote that computer science is no more about computers than astronomy is about telescopes,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a really sums it up well. That obviously computers are very important for computer science,
right?
But it's really about the way of thinking that is applied to computers.
Mm-hmm. So you also use a MacBook, which yes. you got, I think, last Christmas it's or last up, holiday season.
Soon it will be my 1 year anniversary as a MacBook.
So you got that semi recently, I guess. So what inspired the decision to purchase a Mac laptop over a Windows laptop or even a Chromebook, I guess?
Yeah,
but I suppose that was not in your sights.
Yeah, well, actually, I like Chromebooks a lot more than you might think. Certainly mm-hmm. much more than Windows laptops.
Really?
Yeah.
That's surprising.
And a lot of that is because of the clean design language
mm-hmm.
physically and in the operating system. Much of what I don't like about Windows is... Now, granted, I think I'm definitely biased because a lot of my experiences with Windows have been lower-end machines or machines that have been really mm-hmm. buggy, or I've never really had... I've only really had negative experiences with Windows machines compared to Macs. And that, like, within the operating system or the hardware itself. And a lot of that, you know, like, Windows, because it has to run on any machine, then they, from, like, a design standpoint for the operating system, they have a lot more to worry about than mm-hmm. Mac OS does because it's only for a specific set of machines. But the as far as why I chose a MacBook, Mac OS, it's just it's so much more pleasant to use than Windows. That's one of the biggest reasons. I just enjoy it far more. Then another one is the for music, most music people use Macs, and you especially nowadays you can use PCs, but Macs are just, because everyone else uses them, it's simpler to use them also. And then they have software that you can run, like Logic.
Mm-hmm.
And then, honestly, the Macs are just sexy, you know? which I know it's a dumb reason, but it's true.
Yeah. So was computer science at all an aspect in choosing a Mac? Or was it more computer science that influenced, or... music production?
Definitely music, but even if I wasn't doing music, I think I still would have gotten a MacBook just because mm-hmm. even though you can get, you know, you can get better specs for the buck if you get a PC,
yep.
My experience using Macs has always been so smooth and so mm-hmm. buttery and so aesthetically pleasing that I think regardless I would have gotten a Mac unless I was going to be an engineer, because you can't have a Mac if you're being an
yeah.
engineer. But what kind of laptop you have really has no bearing on computer science. You can,
mm-hmm.
unless like Chromebook, I guess that's kind of an exception.
Yeah.
If you have a Mac or PC, you're fine for anything. So.
Yeah. So how did you decide to engage in programming computer science, and why is coding on a Mac necessarily better than coding on a Windows machine? Because you have said that before,
what?
And I'm holding you to that.
Well, if I said that, I guess I'm just going to go back on myself and say that's not true. I don't, maybe I said that, maybe I did, but that's just wrong. I mean, it's not, I enjoy coding on a Mac more because I enjoy Macs more, but it's not inherently better than on a Windows machine.
You even sent me that video of like, or not a video, but you told me that like Tom Scott like says.
Oh, okay. Well, in general, a lot of developers like using Macs more, but I don't think that's necessarily because... Well, you know, I don't, you know, maybe they have reasons, but I don't know exactly what they are.
Mm-hmm.
It's for me, it's just because I enjoy Macs more. What was the rest of the question? Well, why I came to computer science?
Yeah. How did you engage in programming?
That was just, for a long time, I thought I was going to be an engineer. I have two uncles who are engineers and a brother-in-law who's an engineer. But then I went to some, you know, some engineering camps and stuff like that, and I decided it wasn't for me. And then I'd always thought I was going to do something technical, so I said, mm-hmm. I'll do computer science. I took a class junior year of high school, a programming class, and I really liked it. And so I just decided that's what I was going to major in. And I was having a lot of doubts about it, actually, up until I started college, thinking I might switch to something else. But now that I'm doing it, I just love it. And I feel pretty confident that it's what I'm going to stick with.
Gotcha. So what is your dream job? Before I get onto that question, what is the reason that you want to go to college? For some people, it's like they go to college because they want to do the research. They want to understand more about a specific thing, or maybe they like maybe a more party or community atmosphere. But then there's other people who go to college and college is only a stepping point to get a job. So what is your reason for attending college?
Yeah, well, that's, I definitely see that different approaches a lot, that some people very much are just there for the degree and they don't really care about what kind of college you're at. And certainly I feel very blessed that I have the opportunity to go to school like this, and it's not, it's just not an option for a lot of people. But for me, getting a job, yes, that's obviously important, and I need to do that. But a lot of my, I wouldn't have to go to college to get a job. It's just a good way to get a good job. But a lot of the reason, it's a very formative time in your life and a really fun time, honestly, And I don't mean in partying, but just, meeting a lot of people and doing things that you'll never really get an opportunity to do again in a normal work life, where you're just, living in a dorm with people even, and that, honestly, just the experiencing college in that way is a lot of the reason that I chose to go to the kind of school that I am.
So moving on from that, what is your dream job? So if you're going to college to get a job, what specifically is it that you want to do? And is there like a specific use case of computer science and programming that you desire to engage in? Or is your decision to study computer science and hope to apply it to any job that desires that skill set?
Yeah, I don't know, because I don't know what my options are, really. I could be a programmer for just a little piece of a massive collection of moving parts, and I just build this little thing, and then that fits into the giant that is Amazon or something like that. Or I could be working with a startup, doing kind of everything, working to make their whole service go. Or I could end up teaching, or I could end up doing research. And at this point, I'm honestly kind of just waiting till I know more to see what sounds interesting. But I'd be happy doing a lot of different things. And there's not really a specific area that I want to go into at this point, just because there are too many interesting areas that I could try to go into. So
what, give me an example of one of the interests that you have as far as an application.
I guess also a lot of the jobs I could get would probably, most of the jobs I might get wouldn't have anything to do with specific interests outside of just being computer science. If I'm working for some business, chances are I'm not going to be interested in whatever the business is about. But artificial intelligence and efficiency and encryption, things like that. Those are interesting topics, but I don't feel a strong desire or a need to get a job in those areas necessarily. So honestly, I'd be content with really anything.
Gotcha. So going off of AI, I'm kind of interested in simulation theory. Have you given it any thought? And then has your study of computer science influenced the way that you think of it? What influenced what you think of it?
Yeah.
That's a better way to word that.
Well, No, computer science hasn't influenced that any. Well, maybe a little bit, but I guess, okay, so I'll just lay out what I think about simulation. My gut reaction is that that sounds like a load of bull, and no way, that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of things that have come to pass sounded like that a few hundred years before.
Yeah.
Like just the idea of a phone in general and all that it can do would sound absolutely insane 500 years ago.
Yeah.
So I want to push past that gut reaction and actually analyze it critically. Some arguments I've heard are that if you could break the universe down into small enough blocks, like say molecules, mm-hmm. or not like the building blocks of an atom, and then know how all of the forces interact, you know, if we had enough computing power to match up for each, like, to account for each one of those elements, then in theory we could simulate the whole universe. And mm-hmm. so if we suspect that our computing power is moving in that direction, then inevitably we would be able to create a simulation, which makes it seem like we probably are in one. But I don't know that we will get to that level of computing power. And then beyond that, a more philosophical question is, I don't know that the universe could be simulated, because I believe there's more at play than just atoms interacting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
This gets into like determinism and like dualism and stuff yeah. like that. But I think there's an element of a soul, and that's not something you can simulate. That being said, maybe I'm in a simulation that makes it appear that there's a soul and makes mm-hmm. me think I have a soul. So I don't really know. But I still, my gut feeling is that it's not worth pursuing or trying to like hack into the simulation, just because it seems so unlikely. But, you know, I'm not, and it doesn't affect the way I live, just because it seems so unlikely. But even if it was the case, I don't think that would mean I should change the way I live any.
Mm-hmm.
So it honestly doesn't really matter that much to me, I guess.
Yes, I mean, I've heard a lot of the same arguments. But kind of an argument that I've kind of posed to some of those is, if we were to be able to figure out that, yes, this is a simulation, or no, this isn't a simulation, assuming that the simulation wouldn't end as soon as we knew that, maybe, I guess, hacking into the simulation, I mean, as dumb and sci-fi as that could sound, maybe doing that could allow for us to create a greater good in the simulation that we do have. Maybe not escaping the simulation, but making what we live in a better place. So whether that means being able to spontaneously generate food for all people that are hungry, or to end suffering, or to create world peace, or to travel our simulation. Maybe those things are things that we could do if we understood the simulation that we lived in. And so maybe in that way, continuing research on understanding if this is a simulation is important to us. And that could obviously be shot down in many ways by people who just say, well, no, I mean, you couldn't do that. Spontaneously generating food because it's a simulation, that's insane. And I understand where they're coming from and all that. But like, I feel like as humans, we have this sort of desire to just understand. And maybe sort of just giving that up just to say, oh, it doesn't matter. I don't think that's a good solution to anything.
Yeah.
Whether it's trying to figure out if this is a simulation or not, like, who cares? I don't think we should just say, oh, it doesn't matter. Who cares?
Yeah, that's fair. Well, gotta collect my thoughts.
Yeah, it's a difficult topic.
Well, you know, you talked about the if we knew that it was a simulation, if the simulation would end instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that case, I feel like, well, it doesn't really matter. I mean, if it ends, that's fine because it was just a simulation. And then we have no real worth and we don't know that we're dead because we're dead. We're just ones and zeros and it's the end of the simulation.
Right. But I mean, a lot of people would say that they wouldn't want it to end because whether or not it's true or not, it's still an experience that we have.
Yeah, but if...
And whether or not we are we is beyond the point to those people.
Yeah.
So should the actions of us determining whether it's a simulation or not be enough to end the lives of many?
Well, I guess also it depends if it's the kind of... If we're brains on tables...
Yeah.
Or if we're just like ones and zeros, like in a computer, that kind of changes it a little bit. I mean, I guess the idea of hacking into the simulation, that would be great. But also, it feels like that could end up just putting a lot of resources into something
that could just end up
anything,
being like,
and
yeah,
then
baloney.
Ignoring tangible issues at hand, you know, which it, you know, if we were in a simulation and we could hack into it, then like, well, that would be an excellent use of energy, obviously. But I think really just the biggest thing is that it just seems so absurd that the idea of devoting lots of resources to trying to hack into the simulation just sounds far-fetched, you know, even if it would be rational, just because my intuition is that it seems ridiculous. It just doesn't feel like a good use of resources, even if it might be.
Yeah, I see that. But I mean, you said maybe the difference between like brains on a table versus ones and zeros in a computer, does that make a difference? I think we're approaching the point where we need to determine, does that make a difference? Because we're on the verge of possibly creating an artificial intelligence and developing the ethics that we need to be able to cope with that is, I think, important.
You mean around like ethics of...
like how to treat
an
artificial intelligence. And if we end up being artificial intelligence, then how should we treat ourselves in a way?
Yeah. Well,
do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And that's like, it all gets really muddy unless you have Jesus. And then it gets a little bit less muddy, just a little bit, because then humans, if we're created in the image of God, that's why humans deserve respect and a kind of treatment that animals don't to the same degree. Mm-hmm. Still do, but not to the same degree, or like computers. But then, you know, if you come at it from an evolutionary perspective, like that, if we're just a conglomeration of atoms, you know, running and interacting, that the laws of physics are acting upon, then why does this bundle of atoms deserve more respect than this bundle of atoms that's a computer and exhibits the same behaviors? And that's the really hard thing, is that if we look at Siri right now, Siri is not a something that needs, like if you crack your iPhone screen, you're not doing Siri wrong or anything, you know? And a lot of that is also because of confusion with calling things artificial intelligence that aren't. But like it's easy to say about something that's clearly not human, but once something starts acting a lot like human, you know, if it's just kind of like a human, okay, it's just a machine, doesn't matter, we can do whatever. But then if it's a lot, then like it once you got to the point where, say, like robots could perfectly mimic humans and you couldn't tell the difference, well then like how can you say that just something being a robot means that it doesn't deserve treatment, even though it exhibits all of the same characteristics as a human? So honestly, I don't know. And there are going to be some big questions coming up, whatever, you know, just technology brings up so many new moral dilemmas in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
So I don't know. What are your thoughts on treatment of artificial intelligence?
Well, I know you haven't seen Black Mirror yet.
Yeah.
But I'll attempt
you say
to
yet, but I don't know if I'm going to.
I'm going to attempt to describe a scenario that's in one of the episodes. The scenario is there's someone who lives in a smart home. And it's like your typical sci-fi smart home, like the toaster's smart, the oven's smart, the kitchen's smart, like everything's like, it does it all for you. And it's all controlled by like this little, what they call, oh, I forget if it's like a cookie. It is what they call it, a cookie. It looks like a thing of AirPods that just kind of sits on the table. Or like it looks like a smart thermostat or something like that, like whatever. And the way that this cookie is coded is it takes the person who lives in the house, and they undergo like this microsurgery. It's like the two needles stick into their head for like a couple seconds. And what it does is it copies that consciousness, and it puts it into the cookie. And so it simulates a workspace for that person. So the real person still lives, and that real person still lives in the house, but the cookie, a copy of the conscience, controls the entire house for them. So I guess that's more towards the copy consciousness side of it, or, instead of the artificial intelligence. But in a way, we start to see a sort of crossing of the lines. That copy consciousness can't get out. And it is that person, but that person doesn't know that it is themselves. And they're forced into slavery, essentially, for eternity, to just run this person's house the way they like it. So I don't know if offering a sort of compensation to an artificial intelligence for the work that they do is important, or I guess that depends on what service that artificial intelligence is providing, or if it's providing service at all. So like if the artificial intelligence was just designed to be like a PR stunt where it just talks to people and it's like that's what it does, then maybe that is its compensation. But if that artificial intelligence is designed to run your smart home for you, then what can you give that artificial intelligence in return, and what are the laws on ending that artificial intelligence, like hitting the stop button on that program? I think that offering a choice to that artificial intelligence is important, as well as offering the ability for it to express itself. So like you can code an artificial intelligence that thinks on its own, but it has no way of outputting that to the outside world. It can't express that to anyone. And that would be like the cookie just living on its own and not being able to control anything in the smart house. And that's just an extremely boring life for that person. And if it was a human, that's just someone sitting in a room with nothing to do, which we've already seen experiments. I'm sure you've seen that Vsauce video where he locks himself in a room for like 3 days or something.
I don't think I have. Actually.
You haven't seen it. So Michael from Vsauce, he locks himself in a completely white room, like nothing in it. The only thing that's in it is like a whole bunch of bottles of Soylent and a whole bunch of bottles of water and a toilet and a bed. And that's it. And the lights are permanently on. You can't turn them off. So there's nothing for him to do in that room. He can't read. He can't talk to anyone. Nothing. It's an extremely boring life. And he immediately loses track of when his daytime, nighttime sleep cycles are. I think he stays up like 6 or 7 hours later than he would have usually. And he just spirals into a state of like no self-control. So he ends up not being able to think very well at all. And there, he loses his personal connection to everything. So, and it's just a terrible life for anyone to live. So having the possibility of an artificial intelligence living that is a terrible thing, I think. Maybe it's not, because we're developing it on our own and we're developing it to do what we want it to do. But would that not be the same as having a kid only to have it as a slave so it does only what you tell it to do?
Yeah, well, I think all of this really is revolving around a central question of what makes a human a human, mm-hmm. and what makes anything that looks like a human not a human, or is it a human?
Right.
And, you know, like, as a programmer, the idea of, like, giving compensation to a program just sounds ridiculous.
Yeah.
It just because, you know, I open up my editor and I write 20 lines of code and then I, you know, run it and then it prints out hello world and then, like, try to, like, push a 20, like, into my screen or something. You know, that sounds ridiculous because there are transistors and then it's a huge long chain of how that goes to what I type in, outputting the result, but I type in words that manipulate the transistors to do a thing.
Right.
And that is clearly not human.
Yes.
Doesn't feel human, doesn't need compensation.
And it can't think.
Yeah. So then when, you know, I don't believe that there's a point where a program gets complex enough that it can think in mm-hmm. a sense. Now, or can feel emotion. You know, you can make a program that you can program a robot so that you punch it in the face and then it frowns and like
mm-hmm.
it looks sad, but like it doesn't feel sad. It's just performing a behavior that it's programmed to perform. So when you punch mm-hmm. it says, okay, I got punched. So let's do this thing. Okay, let's act sad. And you know, if you believe that humans are just a bunch of atoms being acted upon by physics, then really there's no difference between a human and a really, really complex program
mm-hmm.
that appears to look like a human. But I believe that because we have the image of God, there is a difference in that we're not just a bunch of atoms. So I don't think making a really complex artificial intelligence and then treating it in a way that would be wrong to treat a human, I don't think that's wrong because it's still just a bunch of, unlike humans, which have something more, it's just a bunch of ones and zeros.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's really easy to say when we don't have anything that looks like a human, but once we have an artificial intelligence that could say if we had robots that could look exactly like humans and act exactly like them, that gets a lot more difficult because how do you determine, like, who's a human and who's not or something like that. But this mm-hmm. is getting very far future out there kind of stuff, you know.
I mean, I don't even necessarily think that it's that far future. I mean, I think it's within our lifetime almost.
Perhaps, but I don't think within our lifetime we'll lose the division between human and man-made.
Yeah, I agree.
Which, when we lose that, that's when it gets really difficult.
Right. We get very, very large ethical dilemmas at that point.
Well, and then it comes up like a, say you had like a human that augmented themselves like with prosthetics or something like that and kept doing that until there's just less and less human left. It's like the ship of Theseus, I believe. Hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, at what point then does, you know, if there's like this much brain left, then does that, are they still a human? Or once you're down to just like X amount of neurons, then they're not a human, you know? So
right.
Issues like that could come up. But yeah, it's all in the abstract at this point.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, I guess we haven't necessarily answered this question, but I mean, I guess I kind of want to try, like in a short form. Like, do you think that there is one thing that, if taken away, makes something not human? I say something instead of not someone, because maybe something else could have this.
Well, if it were anything, it would be a soul. But I believe that a soul is not, you know, like Gnosticism is the idea that a soul is like within the shell of a body, mm-hmm. and that it's trying to get out, kind of. But I believe that, I think the Bible paints more of a picture of the soul being, the soul and the body being the same thing, mm-hmm. and not two different things that are in the same location. So in that case, if you could extract a soul from a body, yes, maybe it wouldn't be human, but I don't think that's something you can do because it just is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So really, no, I don't think there's anything you could do to a human to make them not be a human anymore.
Mm-hmm. So
is that what you're looking for or no?
No. That's a good answer. I am 100% okay with that answer.
What do you think?
If there is one thing that we could take away.
Let me say one more thing. Because if you go with behaviors,
mm-hmm.
that is a dangerous path. Because you say, well, okay, this is what a human acts like. Or like, and then you say, well, okay, what if they're brain dead? What if they have disability? Well, what if they don't look like a human because disfigured? Or mm-hmm. you know, like then people who can't speak or people, you know, or are paralyzed or brain dead, I don't mm-hmm. think they're any less human or we should just kill them off because they don't exhibit normal human behaviors. Right. So it's dangerous.
I think maybe the ability to have thought, but not, so you're gonna take this in a way. I think maybe.
I'm smelling what you're stepping in. Maybe. Yeah. I'm smelling your chicken.
not in the meaning like, oh, that person can't think. Well, I guess they're just not a person. So like someone that is brain dead. I think that person is definitely still a human, for sure. But having, I want to say inspired thought, but I feel like that's the wrong way to say it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, like thought that's more than just an exact response based on
thought that's inputs. More than just a search result.
Yeah, or thought that's more than just like plug in A to this circuit and then you get out X, you know. Mm-hmm. Which then it really, again, it comes down to, is there something more in there? Are humans just a bunch of atoms? Because mm-hmm. if we are, even though the mind looks so complex, if it's just a bunch of atoms, then it really is just a really complicated circuit. So you put in an input based on what it perceives, based on all the hormones in the brain and the state of everything else, then it travels through in a certain path and you get some result, which mm-hmm. appears to be thought. But, you know, it's weird thinking about what thinking is.
Yeah, you know? For sure.
Because it's something in our head that it's like we're not displaying it to anything. Like I hear something and then I think about it and then I say something back. So it's not like I'm just hearing words and then spitting out results. Like I'm aware of the intermediate process, but like, it's just like maybe my thoughts are another screen within my brain where like an intermediate step where input comes in, gets processed, then gets shown on my thoughts and then gets sent out. In a way,
yeah.
You know? That's not what I believe, but.
Right. I don't know. I think that sort of like, I think that sort of thought is probably what would make something, I guess maybe not human, but a being that is of that status. Does that make sense? So, like, I think a human is a species, right? So we are humans, but something else could maybe not be our species, but have our same status. Yeah. I think that status, as far as the physical world, is attained by having that sort of thought.
Or maybe maybe we're talking about consciousness here, in a sense, because mm-hmm. you could argue that, some people argue that animals aren't conscious, or that they just have the two things they're thinking about, you know, eating, reproducing, hunting, staying safe, whatever right. it is, and then they get their inputs and then just do things, and they're not really, they don't have free will. I guess this could be about free will.
Yeah. And we've had talks about that before.
Talked about free will a lot.
Yeah. I think that might be, like, at least to me, the thing that you need for something to be of that status. Because I think without having that, I think you can't interact with that.
Yeah.
And sure, you can interact with a dog in the sense that, like, you come home and it's excited. But, like, there's no... I was about to say there's no emotional attachment, but there's certainly an emotional yeah. attachment to dogs.
It's not in the same way as a human experiences,
though. Yes.
And then it's... So then when you scale that up with an AI, like, no matter how complicated it gets, it seems like it wouldn't be able to attain that thought. Unless we can look at a human brain and then determine that the way it works is just a bunch of circuits and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it's just the same as complicated AI. So,
yeah. I don't know. I think this is kind of getting out of my league pretty quick.
Mine too. Got it. This is becoming more of a philosophy discussion.
Yeah. Which I think is important. That's something that I don't see a lot of, or as much as I would like to, is just, I think as a Western society, we undervalue philosophy.
Yeah.
And the study of, like, the way that we think and religion. Absolutely. And all of that. I think that's undervalued in our society.
Yeah. Whenever someone says they're majoring in philosophy, it's usually like, okay, so are you going to become a lawyer? Otherwise, like, an employment major, you know?
Yeah.
And my computer science professor in high school said that he thought society would be a lot better if we paid people just to sit around and think about things.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that.
For sure.
Because, you know, philosophy seems like it's about the abstract and, like, you know, what is all this philosophy stuff matter anyway? I mean, it's a lot of the questions seem trivial about, like, or irrelevant, like what makes something true, like mm-hmm. what is truth, you know, or do we exist or not, you know? Well,
right. What is real?
It doesn't matter the way I live my life, and that is true for some things, but philosophy creates a basis that impacts the way we act in a lot of ways, because, like, the fundamental concept of what makes something human, that's really important for the way we act morally or
yeah,
ethically.
For sure.
So, yeah, but it's hard to fund philosophy because it's not tangible, you know?
Right? Philosophy, you don't get something
money.
Back
yeah.
for it.
You can't, like, pay a philosopher lots of money and then expect them in a year to come back with the meaning of life, you know.
Right.
You can't verify that it is the meaning of life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Can't just plug it into the equation and see if it matches what you got.
Yeah. So, like, what would be, like, the field of study that you're most interested in? Like, not like computer science or, like, mm-hmm. I'm studying computer science so I can get a job. Like, but, like, maybe this is, like, maybe you're interested in studying the way that people interact, or maybe that you're interested in studying religion, or the way the world works, or, like, what just interests you in your personal life, like, something that you want to study.
Yeah, well, there are kind of a lot of things, and then there's just the limitations of practicality. You know, like, I would mm-hmm. be very interested in studying philosophy, But like I said about an unemployment major,
yeah.
As far as getting a job and supporting a family, it's not the best route to go. And computer science is something that I am fascinated with. And so really, I would like if I could study philosophy and music and computer science.
Right, but there's not enough time in the day.
You know, and within philosophy, ethics, and maybe specifically ethics within technology. That's, you know, so like a lot of what we've been talking about today. But yeah, I feel like there's not enough time to learn the things that I want to learn in, you know, in a lifetime. That sounds really pretentious, but like, but I don't know. I mean, I guess it's a good problem to have.
That's a good way to think about it.
What about you?
Like, what am I interested in?
Yeah. If you could study anything without concerns of practicality or, you know, like supporting yourself or anything.
I mean, I think the question of what is real has always been fairly interesting to me. So developing that study, or even like the study of should we study what is real, is something that'd be interesting to me. But also the way that we interact, like studying the way that we interact, like what makes us interact the way that we interact.
Yeah.
So not necessarily studying what do we do, but why do we do what we do?
So basically psychology.
Psychology, but like not mind-centered, like environmental-centered. So like, why does someone from Missouri think all of this where someone from New York would think something completely different?
So I guess that's kind of anthropology also. You got to read this book I was telling you about. I'm going to do a plug for The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. I'm halfway through it and I'm enjoying it immensely. So,
yeah, I need to read more if I'm being honest. So I guess that'd be something I'm also interested in is reading. Because I'm terrible at it. I don't read it all. But anytime I do pick up like a book that's interesting to me, then I can just go.
Yeah.
But it's not very. I guess I'm very picky on what books I read. So like my girlfriend will read like these books that sound so boring. Like one of them was like. I think the title was like To Kill a Boy Band or something like that. And at first I was like Why Boy Bands Should Die. It was something like that.
Is she going to listen to the podcast?
Oh, she hasn't listened to any of it
so
far. So we'll see if that keeps happening. And if not, then I'm going to get yelled at in a little bit. but like I was, at first, very interested in the book. I was like, ooh, why should we kill boy bands? That's intriguing. And then it turns out the whole book was about this group of female friends that went to the concert of a boy band, and they ended up kidnapping the members of the boy band.
Oh, God.
And got involved in a national conspiracy. And as soon as I read that blurb, I put it straight back on the shelf. And then Emma's like, ooh, that looks like a good book. And then pulled it out and read the blurb and was like, oh, I'm taking this. And then she took it home and read it.
Yeah, I had a phase for about maybe 3 or 4 years where I read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, like, adventure books, stuff like that. You know, mild, not really sci-fi, but, like Aragon or The Ranger's Apprentice or Narnia or adventure-y kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But then I outgrew those in a way, or at least not outgrew, but got tired of them because oftentimes it's the same story all over again. And now I'm just kind of starting to have more of an interest in reading again, but in like topics that really interest me, like morality, which, you know, it is more difficult to read, but then it's more rewarding and more interesting than just something about, you know, a boy band.
Yeah.
So I want to, that's a long-term goal is to up my reading and, you know, read more and read things to cultivate my mind. Mm-hmm. Because I can see, you know, the smartest people I know seem to all read a lot. And, you know, shout out to Craig and Ben. So,
yeah.
That's something I want to work on adding more into my life.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess maybe I just haven't found time to read, but I don't want to make that an excuse because I have so much freaking time in
my
life.
I know. Well, same for me. I mean, I'm doing a lot of things, but every minute of my life is not, you know, I spend time just watching random crap on YouTube. Yeah. So I don't have time is a really poor excuse because then you can pull up thousands, millions of examples of people who have far less time than you who are doing far more.
Yeah.
So the moral of the story is just do it. Just figure out how to put it in, you know?
Yeah, I getcha. I've been thinking there's a really, all right. We're recording this on the day before Thanksgiving.
Oh, wow.
Okay, that's for the audience on where we're recording this. But there is a really good Black Friday deal on a couple things. There's a good Black Friday deal on a Chromebook. It's like this 2-in-1 Samsung Chromebook with a pen and everything. Uh-huh. And it's like, ooh, looks really nice. It's very compact, very good screen-to-body ratio. Don't worry about it.
Oh, all right, yeah.
That's actually...
Gotta make sure it's a skinny Chromebook, otherwise gotta shame that.
Yeah. Well, like, you know how, like, you'll get a lot of Chromebooks and, like, it's like, wow, that's so cheap. Like, it's got, like, a nice keyboard. It's got some good I.O. And then you see the screen and it looks like a phone was shoved into the size of, like, a phone screen was just put in a laptop.
Yeah.
And there's this massive, like, 2-inch board around the screen. Yeah. So I think that's totally ugly. So this one has a nice, good, high screen-to-body ratio. It's not insane, but...
good enough.
Yeah. And then there's another one on a Kindle.
Uh-huh.
I kind of want to get a Kindle. Like, I've always looked at a Kindle and was like, oh, that's so cool.
Like one of the black and white ones?
Yeah, the e-ink displays. My grandfather has one. He uses it, like, all the time. He'll always read on cruises. Like, he'll go travel the world and, like, just he's always got the Kindle with him. So I want to say that if I got a Kindle, I would use it and read it, and it would make me read more because it's just like, oh, I spent money on that, so I got to read it. I want to say that. I kind of want to get a Kindle to just see if that happens. I don't know.
Yeah, well, there's definitely, and you know, some of this is just knowing yourself and how you are, how you've been in the past with similar things, but there's certainly something to be said for buying equipment that makes you, that inspires you to do something. Mm-hmm. Like for music, how good your gear is doesn't matter for how good you sound. Like,
to a point.
With a lot of caveats.
Right.
But if a really good drummer can sit down on a piece of crap drum set tuned badly, and they can make beautiful noise.
Right.
You know? But if you're a mediocre drummer and you sit on an incredible thousands of dollars spent on this drum setup, you know, you're still going to sound mediocre. It really doesn't matter. But buying a ride, like a really nice ride cymbal, mm-hmm. replacing my old junky one, that made me want to play jazz so much more because I actually sounded like the jazz that I was trying to play. And it sounded so much better that then I spent so much more time playing jazz because I finally mm-hmm. sounded the way that, like the recordings did in a little bit. Yeah. I could see that. I like try to grasp it, you know. So having a Kindle is not going to make you a reader, but it might make you want to read because you have this new inspiring piece of gear for that. So I say go for it.
I think that is probably the best way that I've heard that, and I've tried to say that to so many people, and they totally laugh at me for it. Like, I'll be like, oh, well, like, I mean, I guess, like, my mom. So, I got a cello that's super nice maybe a few years ago. Huh. And it's, like, this $4,000 cello really nice.
Flex, don't flex on me like that.
Okay, that's very cheap for a cello.
Yeah. Well, that's more than my whole drum setup combined. Yeah. So.
Well, the cello that I was playing on was like a $500 cello, and it was very entry level. And I play on it, and it sounded okay. I mean, it was fine. And my mom would always say, "Well, Yo-Yo Ma could come in here, and he could still play that cello, and it would sound awesome." And I'm like, "Okay, sure, yeah, definitely, I agree." But I can make way better sound on that cello just with less effort.
Yeah.
And that cello cost a heck of a lot of money. I'm gonna value that so much more. Yeah. Like I got this nice case for it. Like I'm gonna try and protect it and make sure nothing happens to it. Like I want to mess with it now because I can make a nicer sound on it easier. And I put so much into it. Like I want to get everything that I can out of it.
Well, and then like you have so much stronger of a desire to actually play and get better when you sound good, you know? Yeah, it's like having a piece of gear doesn't make you any better at what that piece of gear enables you to do, but having a really nice thing makes it a lot easier to want to get better, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I was trying to make that simpler, but that was just more confusing.
Yeah, I get you. All right, I think we're going to close around here. Is there anything that you want to say as a closer, something you want to get off your chest, like anything like that?
Follow me on Instagram at Isaac Vando. I'm trying to hit 500 followers. I'm at 497 right now. I'm a social media influencer. And you should listen to jazz.
Okay. Jazz does not mean anything to a lot of people. Give them a definition. Give them what jazz
is. I don't have a definition of jazz.
Just
jazz.
Where should they get their jazz? What is a good jazz?
Oh. Well, I got a lot of pressure. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, listen to A Study in Brown by Clifford Brown with Max Roach. Or some new stuff, which some older jazz artists don't like to call jazz. Listen to Robert Glasper.
Mm-hmm.
His album Double Booked is excellent. And also Black Radio, the first one or second one, are both excellent. And then also listen to Snarky Puppy. That's another one that is kind of jazz. There you go. That's it.
All right. Thank you, Isaac, for being on the podcast. It's been a lovely time.
It's been fantastic.
All right. See ya.
Bye.
You're listening to Coffee with Creamer.